So I think, as everyone knows, or almost everyone knows, we're now engaged fully in our practice period, giving talks on what we're calling right relationship, healing and connection. And partly inspired, of course, by the pandemic of so long now, we've had to be careful, be isolated, be separate from other people, in some cases even from ourselves. And how do we remember and foster a right relationship? And we're not using the word right relationship in terms of like there's wrong relationship versus right relationship. But rather, I think the sense of right relationship, as I think I mentioned in the opening talks, kind of connected to the Eightfold Path, like right view, etc. And right in that sense, in the Pali word, means more like wholesome, something that does not lead to dukkha, to pain and discomfort in our life. So, tonight I'd like to talk about, well, let's see. We've talked about right relationship in terms of the body. How do we relate to the body? We've talked about right relationship in terms of how do we relate to a broken body, a body that's not doing what we want it to do, injury, sickness, old age. So tonight I'd like to talk about right relationship when we feel there's nothing to relate to. So I'd like to begin by a modern koan, a modern kind of Zen story. And this one is titled, Mae Lee Scott Meets Loneliness. Crying in despair, an earnest student asked her teacher, Seisho Mae Lee Scott, I've worked so hard to transform this crippling loneliness. I can neither shake it nor live with it. Can you help me? Holding the student in a steady gaze and offering her confident smile, Mae Lee ended the conversation with, please don't ever think anything is out of place. This comes from the collection known as The Hidden Lamp, stories from 25 centuries of awakened women that we have, Kate and I have both kind of taken stories from before. So Mae Lee Scott, a contemporary Zen teacher, she was a fully ordained Zen teacher out of the Berkeley Zen Center, and she was also a social worker. She worked with AIDS patients, she fed homeless people in soup kitchens and worked in shelters. She also went into prisons and jails to teach men and women. And she was, as you can probably tell, deeply involved in social activism until she died in 2001. So let me ask you about Mae Lee Scott's reply to her student. How does loneliness have an appropriate place? She said, please don't ever think anything is out of place. So this talk is going to meander a little, so let me apologize in the beginning for that. But really, I want us to consider what is right relationship when we can't find something to relate to. When no matter what direction we turn, there's just isolation from others, maybe from the world, and maybe even from our own self, a sense of being cut off. And many emotions, of course, arise, come into play when we sense that we are somehow profoundly cut off. sadness, depression, alienation, unworthiness, hopelessness, shame, misery, disillusionment, bitterness, etc. But for this talk, I think I'd like to just use the word loneliness, at least mostly, because, because it's a word, of course, we're very familiar with, we can relate to. But please always, I want to use it with the possibility that it is mixed with other, you know, afflictive emotions, loneliness and sadness, for example, because each person's experience is different. Loneliness has its own unique coloring. In reading the literature, at least some of the literature around loneliness, it's usually defined along the lines of a complex and usually unpleasant emotional state in which a person experiences a powerful feeling of desolation and isolation. Loneliness typically includes anxious feelings and thoughts about a lack of connectedness with those nearby, a lack of community with other beings, both in the present and somehow extending into the future, and maybe even a lack of connectedness to the world. Loneliness has been called the disease of our time, and it is on the increase in our modern culture. According to Stats Canada, this is the most recent research I could find, among the fastest growing trends regarding how we live in recent decades has been the rise of single-person households, now well over 28 to 29%. And it's even higher in the U.S., apparently. In the 60s, it was just 10%. And other studies apparently show that we have fewer friends that we can discuss personal and important matters with. One study that I looked at, for example, showed the number of confidants that with whom we can have like a deep personal discussion with has dropped from 3 to an average of 1.2 over the past 15 years. With 3 times more people replying that they have no one to discuss deep personal matters with. So Twitter and Facebook may be a great way to get a message out, but not very helpful for making, of course, a deep connection with somebody, a connection of trust. So let's go back for a moment to the tentative definition of loneliness here. A powerful feeling of emptiness and isolation. And typically, it includes anxious feelings or thoughts about a lack of connectedness with other beings. Notice the definition says a feeling of emptiness and isolation, not necessarily the fact of being isolated. Many people are lonely. Maybe you've experienced that too. Even though they have acquaintances and they have activities that they go to. Many people, let me give you an example. When I was teaching at SFU, I remember one class particularly, my third year students, several students had, they told me, well over 100 friends on Facebook. Some of them had like close to 200. But they found it very hard to reach out to their peers in a class and even ask to borrow a pen. And haven't we all been lonely in a crowd of people? Yeah? And maybe it's in a crowd when we most painfully experience a sense of loneliness. When What's that song go? One is a lonely number. But maybe it's like 10 is a lonely number. 20 is a lonely number. At times, of course, loneliness comes when we are even with a life partner, but we don't feel a strong connection. There is, of course, no stereotype for a person who's caught in loneliness. As one psychologist wrote, loneliness is an equal opportunity emotion. It touches everyone. Now, there are many ways that each of us kind of can cut ourselves off. Of course, we can be cut off by something happening from the outside, but often we cut ourselves off. We have an abiding anger that we can't let go. We have a longing for something that cannot be, some situation or way of, or lover that we can't have, you know, a person we love but can't connect with, it simply cannot be. Grief, maybe a strong sense of self-protection, and of course avoiding the coronavirus, right? All of this can lead to ways that we cut ourselves off. But another way is, I think, one of the most poisonous, and that's self-criticism. Or criticism through what we call the critical voice. You know, of course, self-honesty is important. You know, really look at yourself clearly, but the harsh critical voice is always disturbing, it's crippling, and disempowering. This is the voice that can be the most insidious obstacle when it creates a pattern of negative inner comments that can undermine our own well-being or our view of others while, you know, trying to protect ourselves. And often the critical voice uses kind of like partially true comments. So let's call this, I'm going to divide it into two. I'm going to call it the inner critic and the outer critic. So the inner critic, this is the voice inside informing us of our value and the rightness of our actions, right? So this voice often reinforces a sense of incompetence, unworthiness, failure, causing us to kind of withdraw from others. We are not worthy. It can cause us to withdraw from a sense of our belonging to the world and even from the greater sense of who we are, this inner critic. And it's interesting and sad, but a hallmark of the inner critic is that it often puts us in a double bind, damned if we do and damned if we don't, right? It tells us we don't do anything right. It carps. It calls us stupid. It compares us to other people in a negative light, of course, and speaks harshly about ourselves and our bodies. It tells us that the things we did or said are wrong, even when we make an effort to try communicate or connect with somebody. So I think we all kind of have an idea of what the inner critic is, but there's also what I will call here the outer critic. And this is the voice that projects criticism outwards onto others so that we ourselves can feel a little better about ourselves, so that we can avoid the possibility of others thinking poorly of us, and maybe so that we can avoid our own inner critic beating us up. But whether it's the inner critic or the outer critic, both can lead to a profound sense of isolation, cutting us off from others, cutting ourselves off from the world, and I think particularly with the inner critic, even cutting ourselves off from the wholeness that we are. It diminishes us. So when, for whatever reason, we find ourselves in isolation or that sense of loneliness, how do we relate to that? Who is the one that is lonely? Who is the one that is lost here? I have talked about my experience in Japan as a young man before, but I just kind of want to repeat part of the story here to give an example of what I just talked about, this sense of loneliness and the inner and outer critic. So when I was 19, as I think at least some people here know, I went to live in a small city in Japan to study Aikido with the teacher of my a teacher who lived in Vancouver here at the time. And it was marvelous in many ways. And after, though, around 6 months, as I recall, my teacher, whom I had been living with, became quite busy with other students and with other areas of his life. And at the same time, my one kind of Japanese and a friend and fellow student who I kind of chummed around with started to have more family responsibilities. So abruptly, I was alone for much of the time. It was an isolation that had a very different quality to it, one that I had never experienced before. And one aspect that was unique about it was that my usual ways of dealing with loneliness no longer worked. Not having money, I couldn't go shopping or go to coffee shops and restaurants. I couldn't take pleasure watching TV since I didn't understand Japanese at that time. And there was only one small bookstore that in the city that carried any Japanese books, and it was like
English books,
yeah, handful of English books, which I couldn't afford anyway. And there were no other foreigners in the city except for one woman who was teaching at the university there, whom I almost never saw. So it was a very painful and yet also a very fruitful time. As the weeks passed, my loneliness deepened and it became a kind of desperation. The inner critic, with its great carping voice, was quite loud. I should leave, go back to Vancouver. I'm not getting much out of training anymore anyway. I've already been here 6 months. Nobody here likes me. I'm this weird foreigner that people point at and call gaijin. I'm so unhappy. There's no one to talk to. Now, I realize that perhaps most of us here have been in a situation where similar thoughts and feelings have come up. But what made this a fruitful time for me was that I was stuck. It was not easy to arrange my travel back to Vancouver because I didn't speak Japanese. I needed someone to help me a little bit to at least call an airline and get someone who could speak English at that time. So it wasn't easy to arrange travel back. But what I found most hard was thinking about trying to tell my teacher, who had housed me and fed me and taught me for free for 6 months, that I wanted to leave before the year was up. So I was trapped by my reluctance to face my teacher. And as the weeks passed, I lived with that loneliness. And I gradually came to just be with it. Much of the day, I would spend in a large public Japanese garden, a very beautiful one, walking the paths, looking at the carefully maintained landscapes. And I went to that garden because my loneliness eased a little bit while I was amongst the trees. But gradually, without realizing it really, or intending it, I turned towards my loneliness. And at a point, something accompanying that loneliness cried out from, I think, from that loneliness itself. It cried out to my loneliness. It was something deeper and different from my usual sense of myself. Now, my usual sense of being is of a self that's separate from the world and others. And I think that's probably your sense of self most of the time too, right? You're a little person knocking around in the world, in your body, and things happen to you. In that kind of deep despair that I felt, that deep isolation I was into, that I fell into as a young man, the possibility of solitude suddenly arose. Solitude, this is my definition, is when we rest in our isolation and see it for what it is. In some mysterious way, loneliness, if we can abide with it, renders the heart capable of meeting itself. Now, there are many ways to deal with loneliness. And a brief look at any self-help website will provide various suggestions like volunteering, adopting a pet, talking to strangers, joining a class, regular exercise, etc. And any of these could be very helpful depending on your situation. However, I would like to suggest the Buddhist tradition says that right relationship arises with loneliness when we keep company with our loneliness. Let me read two poems by the Japanese poet and Soto Zen priest Ryokan. Ryokan Taigu, that's his full name, was a much beloved, gentle, itinerant monk who lived in Japan in the 1800s. He's famous for playing with children in the village. He wrote poems for his friends. He lived in a simple one-room hut, and he survived by begging, traditional Buddhist way of surviving. He survived by begging, and mostly he chose the families of simple farmers and fishermen for his friends. Toward the end of his life, he fell in love with a young nun, Teishan, and they wrote poems to each other. He's quite an amazing character. Anyway, here are the poems that I wanted to read you by Ryokan. And these were written while he lived in his hut that he would up in the mountains. First poem. In the blue sky, a winter goose cries. The mountains are bare, nothing but falling leaves. Twilight, returning along the lonely village path, alone, carrying an empty bowl. Next poem. Foolish and stubborn, what day can I rest? Lonely and poor this life. Twilight, I returned from the village, again carrying an empty bowl. An empty bowl would be his begging bowl, right? Dokkan chose to live a solitary life. And in some of his poems, he celebrates the joy of a simple life. But in these two poems, he shows us his intimacy with loneliness and the quiet sadness that is also a part of his life. He doesn't attempt to distract himself or escape, but he embraces this as simply part of his humanness. This too. In both poems, you notice the bowl is empty. I kind of picture it as receptive. As is Dokkan, is receptive to the wholeness of his life. Periods of loneliness, periods of joy. I think in reading Dokkan's poems, not just these two, but if you read a book of his poems, you'll see that he's open to the vast changing nature of human experience. And nothing left out. I think this is because Dokkan knew that the sense of I am, is in fact an illusion. Perhaps our most dangerous illusion or delusion, because we fail to acknowledge our true intimacy with the other, our true intimacy with the whole world. Without being aware of this intimacy, names and pronouns such as I, me, mine, myself, they create the illusion that there must be something that's referred to. Right? If the word laptop refers to this thing as I'm typing away, then the words I, me, and mine logically must refer to something in the same way. A language misleads us. Because the Buddhist understanding from the very beginning and up through our tradition is we are completely woven into the fabric of this universe. Let's go back to the koan I read at the very beginning, Maylie Scott Meets Loneliness, and that final comment that she made to her student, please don't ever think anything is out of place. Well, there may be times of deep and abiding despair that requires treatment. When we keep company with our common or typical loneliness, it usually moves on in its own time. Perhaps loneliness is not the essential cry that something is wrong. If we can let go of our ideas about getting rid of it somehow, you know, watch Netflix, fire up the computer, send off emails, open a beer, eat chocolate. If we can give up or let go of our ideas of trying to get rid of it, maybe then we can ask, what is it you're here to teach me? What is it you're here to teach me? What happens when you just allow loneliness to be? Making room for loneliness, we make room for everything. And then I think together with Dokkan, we feel with clarity the inner pain of, yes, being a separate self, and at the same time open, beyond that limited confusion, to a kind of wordless belonging. Well, let me give you one more koan to explain that last comment. Once, a monk on pilgrimage, met an old woman living alone in a hut on the side of a mountain. And the monk, feeling sorry for her, asked, "Do you have any relatives?" And she replied, "Yes." And the monk asked, "Well, where are they?" Thinking probably, "Why aren't they here to take care of you?" And she answered, "The mountains, rivers, and the whole earth, the plants, the trees, are all my relatives." When we listen with compassionate care and patience to our most painful songs that we sing to ourselves, and fully opening to our own pain of loneliness and isolation, we come to know that ours is a shared loneliness. This universal pain is part of our connection itself, part of our connection to one another. We are not alone. Even in the depths of our loneliness, so I'd like to close with a poem that I think very powerful, and maybe I'm sure many of you have heard this poem before, by William Stafford, the American poet, and he wrote, "You will never be alone. You hear so deep a sound when autumn comes. Yellow pulls across the hills and thrums. Or the silence after lightning before it says its names. And then the clouds' wide-mouthed apologies. You were aimed from birth. You will never be alone. Rain will come, a gutter filled, an Amazon, long aisles. You never heard so deep a sound, moss on rock and years. You turn your head. That's what the silence meant. You are not alone. The whole wide world pours down." Well, thank you for listening. I am watchless, so I see if I can do it. I got a watch. Oh, thanks.
There's time.
Okay. So as we have done on the other days, we're going to be getting into groups, and I'll give you a question to consider. And it works like this, because I know there's a couple of new people here. Each person will get about 3 minutes to kind of, not exactly answer, but respond to the question, whatever response you want to give. And the other two people will just listen carefully, fully, with their full attention. And when the speaker has finished speaking, you can just sit in silence together until I ring the bell again, and then the next person will go. And then whatever is said in the small group just stays in the small group. So, you know, you don't bring it up anywhere else unless that person does so themselves. Okay, I think that's enough. I'll need a bell. If you could pass me the bell on a stick. Yeah, that's a good. And here's my questions. Is how do you respond to loneliness? That's when you're with a sense of isolation, both wholesome and maybe unwholesome ways, but just how do you respond? And also consider how would you like to respond? often we're caught in a rut, right? So just think about, how do you respond to loneliness? And how, perhaps, would you like to respond? Or something from the talk, the poems or anything I've said would be fine. Please don't talk about sports. So, if people could just get together in groups, there's one group of four, I guess, and three and three. And then I'll put people here into groups as well. So just to hang on for a moment here. This will be random. Let's see.
So Zendo people just cluster so that you're facing each other, these four, and tell each other your names.
Okay, I'm going to send you guys off to your rooms. Please, of course, self-time as usual. Here you go. That looks good.
James, I'm Michael.